Hi, everybody, and welcome back to another Hard Truth podcast. My name is David Vance.
And I'm Alana Mercer. Hi, David.
Hi, Alana. Great to see you again. And we catch up on this podcast on a weekly basis, folks. So do make sure you hit the subscribe button so you can be notified and get alerts of all the stuff we do. So if you could do that, I would really appreciate that. Right, Alana, we're going to talk about, someone who is in many regards the toast of a certain form of conservative thought. And that chap is a guy called Douglas Murray. And Douglas, Alana, came to my attention. Well, I'm well aware of him over many years. There's a particular article, we should talk about, I think, that he put out over on Unaired. So we chat about that. I did wonder what your sort of overview of Douglas Murray was.
Well, you know, I think I'm going to refer to a brilliant an email that you wrote to me, because it focuses his writing. We are actually discussing a nullity, something that is almost not there. It is ephemeral. Mm-hmm. You can't grasp anything. And in fact, I have never had interest in a few tidbits that he has emitted, I wouldn't buy his books or anything. One of his books is Neoconservatism and Why We Need It. So philosophically wrong, but that's all fine. That's all fine. He's somewhat reversed himself. But David, you always send me a great reading material. You're extremely focused, ruthlessly focused. And I could not, this was like 2,000 words each of articles, and I could not see the ability to distill a big idea. I saw a lot of syntactical and grammatical infelicities, so not a great writer, and very untidy. Sometimes on the critical race theory article that you want us to discuss, he gets to it at the end, the last paragraph. The absolutely underwhelming conclusion is arrived at the end. As a ruthless editor myself, on my text, I would just put a red pen through everything and leave the 200 words of the end. So let me just say what you said in the email to me. You said, let's tackle milquetoast. I don't think anyone knows what that means. Wonderful word. Conservative Murray in particular. We can use that bizarre article he has penned on critical race theory as a starting point. And then you said he shies away from the anti-white animus because there's nothing more to critical race theory, as we have established in these broadcasts, than anti-white program, a developed anti-white program, systemic, institutionalized. And then you said, we'll scan his slow death of Europe. By the way, even the title, you have it. You can, don't advertise.
It's gone.
your go to sleep quick medicine there. And you said, and by the way, Slow Death of Europe is even the title is cribbed from a Brit. Do you know the British author he took the title from?
I did, having read your article about it, Alana. Yeah.
So he did crib that title. So that doesn't seem to matter to Con Inc. And you say to me, he flags open borders, which is fine. I think Peter Brimlow and American patriots have been doing that since the late 1980s. Welcome. He flags open borders and Muslim immigration, as us patriots have been doing for decades. And then you say something really amusing, and it's all a long sustained moan. David, a long sustained moan is more creative English than Douglas Murray ever manages. A long sustained moan that avoids the need for muscular confrontation and defense. Yeah. And then you say, the madness of crowds you fell asleep on. So his books are your domain, and we can try and struggle through the articles.
So what I was saying was that his article is called The Fight Back Against Critical Race Theory, but the subheading on it is, its creators thought America was on their side, they were wrong. Well, no. They didn't think that America was on the side because couldn't care less about America. Well, apart from despising white America. So even at that point in the article, Alana, my sort of radar was going off thinking this is a really unusual introduction. And then, like you say, you start to read through it and it just is nothing. It's a couple of thousand words.
Yeah. I mean, it's non sequitur after non sequitur. And the final paragraph, what he wants to say is that he gets to his point in the final paragraph. That's why I say, as an editor, I would just put a red line through all of it. He says, what he wants to say is critical race exists, as a very large number of Americans have discovered, it exists. It's being exported to the world. And that's a strong point he could really make as an Englishman, he could make a strong stand on that. And in fact, we've been over that one article where I wrote that Douglas Murray wanders, across London, and he sees these very atavistic, violent imagery of Black Lives Matter. And he says to himself, why does this belong here? And I completed the thought in my own article in this most English of cities, and why do we even listen to Black Lives Matter when this imagery, the slavery, it's all alien, it's American. So he has the chance to make this powerful point that as an Englishman he can dissociate from it, but he can't even bring himself to that. And finally he says, critical race theory has had a bad reception, something about the general public is coming hip to it. Those are my words, not his. He's not very articulate. And that's the point. But the point is arrived at in a succession of non sequiturs and verbosity. Yes. He starts with saying the word gaslighting and saying how he hates the word gaslighting, not defining it. You said, as a writer, I think a writer really gets to the point, myself, I never use concepts that I don't know. And so you've noticed I will never say binary or intersectional. I don't understand these, David. One day you can sit me down over a glass of wine and explain them. But I avoid anything I don't understand in my own work. And so I will say to you, and we've coined this, hets, homos, and anything in between. That's how I put it in columns, because I think everyone understands that. So he starts... gaslighting, half a page goes on gaslighting, and I still don't know what gaslighting is.
Yep, same here.
Then he goes to another paragraph where he doesn't define critical race theory, doesn't even define it, and then he tells you what Washington Post says about it. Then he does mention concepts that are vital, decentering whiteness, white supremacy. He hints that critical race theory is something really bad in schools, but he doesn't say why. And what does he say? He says it's bad for certain people, but he won't come out with it. Whereas he even quotes a schoolmaster, it's terribly evil for whites, for white children. But he says you shouldn't problematize whiteness. So he doesn't come out with anything, David. So what did you read into that article?
Well, very much like yourself, Alana, but there were some bits in it that just totally didn't make sense. For example, at one point in the article, he talks about that critical race theory's decades long advocates are no longer being honest. Well, hang on again, Alana. At what point were they ever being honest? I find these things, I don't get it. I mean, he goes on in a couple of paragraphs on, he goes on to talk about the fact that in that sense, this is about CRT, it's a bit similar to the problem experienced by Marxists, because he's bringing in the Marxist angle, which you and I have talked about before. Yes. On paper, Marxists can obviously make their grandiose claims, but try it on the public, and they soon learn that what worked on paper did not work in practice. But the point is, CRT
doesn't work in on paper, let alone in practice, apart from being the kind of visceral, hate-driven ideology that you and I have talked about. So yes. I just found this, like, it's almost like a jigsaw where everything fits in the wrong hole, and you're trying to read it and make kind of coherent sense of it. And for me, Alana, the punchline, sometimes you need to cut to the chase, his punchline is, he sort of says, the only group to blame for the bad reception is the creators, and he says it is their fault, not ours, that their ideology's first mass encounter with the general public.
Exactly. And David, he is part of the debate. In other words, he's there debating critical race theory to accept or not, instead of doing what you and I have done, and that is go meta and just throw the whole thing out by exposing the foundations of the thing, the anti-white program sustained, institutionalized of this thing. So he doesn't define it, as you say. He says it does focus on a demand for social justice. He does say that much. But that's about it. And then, as you say, his whole article is about how it's been badly received by people that he would, I think, clandestinely want to be received positively by Washington Post and the elites, and it's been badly received, and as you said, it's not our fault, it's their fault, because it's not a good theory, and 2,000 words about this, like that.
Well, you see, I'm not going to show you his book again, Alana, because that's way too much publicity. But where I really struggled is, I'd forgotten actually, until you and I started to talk about this article, when I revisited The Strange Death of Europe, or tried to remember what I'd done, I had found exactly the same problem as the one we're talking about. I tried to get into it to try and understand it, but ultimately, it's an awful lot of words. And very nicely chosen words, pretty words, which don't really go anywhere. It's just like that meandering he did in London that you picked up on, Alana, where he wandered around and he seen the BLM imagery, but he couldn't really go beyond that. And this is the problem with guys like him in general. That's from my perspective. You know, they want to be loved. Now, we want to be loved as well. But,
oh yes, we do. No chance.
Well, yes, but no chance. I think it's maybe too late in the day for that one, Alana. But you know, again, he talks about a subject you and I have really, I think, discussed in some detail in the previous times, and it's just a big nothing. There's nothing there except that, you know, as I say, from the very, very sort of the very title of it, where he starts to sort of then to speculate on the fact that, what did he say at the beginning here? I've got it here. It's creators thought America was under. So, I mean, what's that about? I found it infuriating. And that's why I wanted to share it with you, because we don't hold back in terms of confronting the issues.
Intrigued that you did say his book was quite well written, because these two articles, I don't know if they are in any way representative of his work, but they are meandering and badly written, and quite a few grammatical errors. For instance, he says holding prejudicial attitudes. You know, it's kind of sloppy and that sort of thing. I don't like, especially someone who's so hailed. But David, you know, especially in this Twitter article, which is actually, I thought it would be frivolous, but it's an important topic. He shows in this article about Twitter's anniversary an inability to distill big ideas. And lest people think that we are being critical being able to compare to someone who does that of his genre, and we are just patting ourselves on our shoulders, take Mark Stein, who... Yeah. is also a reformed neoconservative, and he came to immigration late. For instance, Mark Stein in 2005, when France erupted in the riots, the Muslim riots, Mark Stein was of the bunch of neoconservatives like Krauthammer and other, who was the gentleman, and all the Wall Street Journal individuals who actually really showed schadenfreude. You know, they were happy for France's plight, and they were actually saying, oh, we in the United States, we assimilate. They were actually justifying, if you look at the meta argument, the multiculturalism, the fact we assimilate, we accept Muslims, but we also assimilate. They, and France was to be commended. They had erupted because they are very chauvinistic about their culture, David. They don't have affirmative action. You see very few, shoddy characters in government there. I mean, they're all shoddy characters. Macron is a shoddy character. Mm-hmm. But what I'm saying is there's very little affirmative action and so on. They don't have all that. So in 2005, Mark Steyn, and to immigration, he came very late, and he's admitted that. But the man is bright. The man is brilliant. He can distill ideas. He gets to profound ideas. His oratory is magnificent. His writing can be a little long-winded, but so much better than Murray's. So there's an example, lest our, our listeners or our viewers say that, oh, they're just, they're patting themselves on their shoulder. There's a public intellectual with gravitas, a former neoconservative, and Murray just doesn't have it. The Twitter article, for example, David, which you sent me very wisely, because it's very important, there's a deep, as I read the nonsense that he writes, there's childish hyperbole, he blames Twitter for all societal ills. You and I, you're banned on Twitter. You had a huge account, you're banned. I'm shadow banned. But I can still appreciate that prior to censorship, the main issue with Twitter is censorship. Mm-hmm. That's the main issue, which he absolutely skirts. He does not touch censorship. In fact, he celebrates that Neil Fuentes has an odious character, he calls him, has been, and Katie, what's your friend, Katie Hopkins. He celebrates that he celebrates that Trump has been ousted. He has no feel for Lockean freedoms, freedom of speech. So Twitter, the main problem with Twitter, it's a magnificent forum, compare it to Parler. Parler's like a coffin. You go nowhere. But Twitter is a brilliant design. It's the problem with Twitter is the censorship. But Murray does not alight on that. And another thing, David, before I give it over to you, is as I read his meandering ad hoc non sequiturs, Murray's, Douglas mm-hmm. Murray's, the main issue that he needed to reflect upon is, does Twitter reflect society or does it create reality? Those are the deep, profound questions that are in this article, and he cannot get to it. In other words, he says, oh, Twitter's terrible. There's blow-ups between people. It's petty. It's horrible. It's created. It's as bad as Ebola, he says. What childish hyperbole. But he doesn't zero in on, am I explaining myself, David?
Yeah, you are.
Zero in on the issue as, is Twitter merely reflecting in all these awful people that congregate on this platform? Is it reflecting society or is it creating reality on the ground and influencing how society is? And I would say that's the profound question here. He's incapable of getting at it. I would say it's a bit of both.
Yeah, well, you see, I think just like so much of the rest of his work, Alana, he doesn't want to be banned from Twitter. He doesn't want to be me. He doesn't want to be banished from these salons, you see. And this is why ultimately these milquetoast Praetorian guards of neoconservatism ultimately leave me cold. And that was the problem with his books as well, Alana. You know, I wouldn't say they were beautifully written, but the language in some elements is okay. But I think the soul is missing, the heart is missing, and it comes across in his little sort of Twitter stuff that he put out there. Again, as you said, I mean, you've summed up really nicely there. Actually, the one of the deep conversations, one of the deep issues that could be talked about. And this guy's a public intellectual or an alleged public intellectual. He doesn't want to talk about those things at all. He wants to talk about people saying hurty things on Twitter. Well, I'm sorry, but you've got to man up and accept these things.
And exactly. And the other thing is he shows a very sort of, feminine quality of inability to separate the real issues from the white noise. You and I don't follow all these issues he seems to follow on Twitter. No. In fact, I find that Twitter, I resent it because it shadow bans me, but I find that Twitter is actually hasn't made, he says, oh, all the serious people that he respects, which is obviously not you and I, the serious people that he respects have deteriorated on Twitter. But well, I find that it makes me focus an idea really well. So if I put out a tweet, I am forced to something I would write in a paragraph, I'm forced to really focus well. So it can do the absolute opposite. So he focuses on all these very, very petty issues about Twitter. And you and I have real reason to be upset with Twitter. He has none.
That's right. Absolutely right. He has no reason to be upset with Twitter, except in these vague ways that he then seems to obsess around. So it is very, very peculiar. And that's why I wanted us to focus on Douglas Murray, because as I say, he's hailed as a little prince of the alleged conservative right. And I mean, I was looking again. I'm not going to show it, but I've got the Slow Death of Europe book in front of me, and there's a guy called Clive James who you may know. He was an Australian guy living in the UK, media guy. People will, I guess, Brits will know him anyway. I think if he's not dead, he's been seriously unwell for a long time. But this is his quote on the back. I'm going to just quote it to you. It'll give you a laugh. He says, this is in relation to Douglas Murray, "I found myself continually wishing that he wasn't making himself quite so clear." What? Come on. Making himself quite so clear, he couldn't be more opaque and more
exactly. Good word, yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Like that's right. And I think, Alana, that's the difference, if I may say, between, for example, your style of writing and the stuff you've put out, and Murray. Your stuff is absolutely clear. The points are made with clarity, precision, verve and vim, to use the Freudian expression, and. Whereas what Murray does is he writes endlessly and it all goes nowhere and it doesn't achieve anything. And so I don't understand how Clive James could have said that, I wish he wasn't quite so clear. He couldn't be less clear.
A friend of mine says, well, we love Tucker Carlson, of course, but a friend of mine puts it quite well. He says, when Tucker puts on the checkered shirt and starts, crowning public intellectuals, it all goes wrong. And don't do it. This guy is just not worthy. You know, we could go through every paragraph and it would just be ad hoc, a lot of non sequiturs. In other words, his conclusion in the sentence or in the paragraph doesn't follow from the premise. Lots of bad English. Maybe Unheard doesn't have Unheard, the website he writes for. There are some very good writers there.
There are.
Much better than he. In this Twitter article, unable to zero in on the big philosophical issue. So his pieces are never think pieces. And also so full of distractions, goes off. It's like Homer Simpson running after a butterfly, you know, or saying, can't talk eating.
No, but the thing is that he has tackled big issues like immigrations, like CRT, and he does them a complete and absolute disservice. That's the thing that annoys me the most. If you're going to take on these issues, then you know you really do owe it to the topic, let alone to your readers, to pursue the logic to the conclusion. And he is like that. He is like Homer, actually, off all over the place, basically. And except, then it all comes together.
Except Homer's lovable, you know. But David, don't you think you might be giving him the benefit of the doubt, saying that he has the ability, but he's just not delivering because he wants to be in polite society? Maybe if you look around us and all the hailed intellectuals in public discourse, they are often mediocrities. They are mediocrities, whether they are the ubiquitous blonde on Fox or, you know, the even stupider people on CNN and MSNBC, they are mediocrities. They don't threaten the anchor in the ego in the anchor's chair, you know, and a talkful I don't mean to sound anti-American. De Tocqueville was certainly a Frenchman, very pro-American, but he did make the point in his book Democracy of the tendency towards mediocrity in America, towards, you know, this two-party mush. As soon as you veer. And I wondered, you know, when I wrote a brief blog about Douglas Murray, when Tucker Carlson, as he often has Candace Owens on to make sense of the most, Tucker makes wonderful sense of issues, but I guess his producers or his bosses make him have people on that don't make sense, but really vexing and deep issues like race, and he'll have Candace Owens on. Luckily, he hasn't had Ben Shapiro on. He did this wonderful foray to Hungary, which was
Tucker did
marvelously, as is his wont. He's a smart, deep-thinking man. And then he had Douglas Murray come on the show to explain why the absolute hatred in the international community and in the globalist community here against Hungary. And all Douglas Murray could come up with is that this hatred happened when Hungary decided to enforce its borders. Now, that's all he came up with. That's all he came, and that's where he walled the debate off. It was about the borders. Angela Merkel let in all those million Muslims, and Hungary refused. And then Douglas Murray sat back and puffed up his little fit chest, and that's it. That was his say. But, you know, I wrote the blog that said, "Happy homogenous Hungary." Urban's motto.
Yeah.
I mean, Urban's motto is. What is his motto there? I think it's procreation, not immigration. And he often has, and Hungary is very homogenous, and it's very, very happy in its homogeneity. And that is exactly what irks the international community about that. And it's almost as if, and I wrote in this blog post, it's almost... it's not just that enlightened Western media object to Hungary exercising its right to self-determination. No, the media treat the right of the sight of fruitful, happy whites as they would an aberration, a plague. Freud would have called this Western attitude thanasos, and that means courting death. In other words, as soon as the mindset is pathological. It is pathological for Hungarians to look beautiful, happy, homogenous, and whole. So if he had, you know, the proverbial pear, Douglas Murray would have said that. You know, that's what Viktor Urban is promoting. He's promoting the nation. It's Hungary first. Yep. But all he could come up with is what Peter Brimlow invented in 1980, you know, immigration, borders.
But you see, just in the same way as he shied away from Hungary first, and I did listen to quite a bit of Tucker's interview with Viktor Orban. I missed the Douglas Murray bit, but I did listen to Tucker talk to Viktor Orban. And you summed it up well, Alana. But, you know, Murray shied away from Hungary first, just as he is all the vitriol for Donald Trump and America first. So at least he is kind of consistent in this kind of weak mind, this refusal to actually understand the key issues. But certainly as far as Hungary is concerned, Hungary's for Hungarians. Orban's made it clear he wants to encourage the family values, the whole essence of that country's rich history and culture, and that's what immigration is actually almost a side issue. Yes, he naturally wanted to protect his borders, whilst the rest of Europe was obviously happy to open theirs up. But this is the issue with our friend Douglas Murray. You know, on time after time after time. So it's a trend. It's a trend, Alana. It's not just a one-off. It's on fundamentally pretty much every big issue. He just runs towards it. And then at the last moment, he swerves to one side, like Homer after the butterfly. And therefore, he doesn't actually contribute anything of value, I suggest. Some people may disagree. I know he's got his fans. He's got his fan club out there. And, of course, I'm sure he'd be very welcome to come on to this podcast and discuss these matters with us.
He wouldn't look at us. He's huge. So, yes, Urban Plumps for Closed Borders, pro-Western Christian Hungarian Families First Policies. And this small fact that Tucker had articulated throughout his stay there, it's almost like Tucker reverses or goes backwards or is stagnating when he has someone on like Murray. He's gone through the effort of stating what's happening. He's broken through that wall, and there he has Murray putting the debate back. Before I run out of things to say about Murray, because you know me, I have nothing more to say about him. But he did. This is interesting tidbit that even Hungary proceeded quite vigorously against George Soros, who's the agitator for global government.
Yep.
And by the way, Donald Trump's State Department had sent a stern rebuke to Hungary, claiming that its anti-Soros law will cost the country dearly. So even under Donald Trump, who could not, of course, controlled his State Department, Hungary was being threatened by the deep state and the government in America.
Yeah, no, absolutely right. Yeah, just to wrap it up, I think, Alana, you know, the thing is that the lesson that Tucker Carlson got from Viktor Orban in Hungary was, which is essentially neatly encapsulated as Hungary first. Those lessons are equally relevant to the United States. It's a warning, just as your book Into the Cannibal's Pot was certainly a warning to the U.S. and the rest of Europe. It annoys me when people who give proper warnings,
exactly,
these are ignored, and these pseudo intellectuals like Murray, then just like a butterfly flying over the thing, don't really land anywhere or make any impact whatsoever beyond assuring themselves their position on Tucker and in other salons of the establishment media,
David, he even had the opportunity, and you said the relevance is to UK as well. Your saving grace is that you're an island. And in fact, as we were watching the horrific invasion on the southern border in the US, it's just, there's nothing to say. I think we've reached the tipping point. I will not write about immigration much because it's over, David. It's over. You've seen what's happening on the south. The world has been invited to settle America, and that's the sad truth of it. And in the UK, at the same time I watched BBC International, you were quibbling over the fact that 14 Iranian kids had come over in a boat and were being settled, and everybody was upset. And I thought, Britain has a problem. It cannot articulate about immigration. It doesn't. Other than Brexit, it's been inept. However, the magnitude of the problem is so much less. 14 children, and look at this, it's going to be 2-3 million by next year that have just invaded this country. So Murray had the opportunity to say, look what's happening on the border and take it to the next level. There's a reason Hungary cannot afford what's happening on your border, but he couldn't even do that.
Yeah, and it's the same reason why no country can afford that. But yeah, absolutely right. He wants to shy away from the stuff. Well, Alana, listen, I think we've reached the end of our allocated time. So it just remains for me to thank you, Alana, again, for being here on Hard Truth Podcast. Thank all of you who either watch this or listen to it for your support. Just make sure you hit the subscribe button, and we shall be back to put the world to right this time next week. In the meantime, it's goodbye from me.
Thank you, David. Bye-bye.
Bye, everybody.